In 1952, President Eisenhower, recognizing the extraordinary abilities of this man, asked him to become Secretary of Agriculture, and he served that position for 8 years. On October the 7th, 1943, President Benson became a member of the Council of the 12 Apostles. Today, he serves as president of that quorum. Now I present to you our beloved President Ezra Taft Benson.
My soul is subdued and my feelings a bit tender as I look into your faces tonight. I speak to you humbly and gratefully. I am not here to tickle your ears, to entertain you. I shall speak to you honestly and frankly. The message I bring is not a particularly happy one, but it is the truth. And time is on the side of truth. I love this country. With all my heart, I love America. I have traveled abroad just enough and returned to the shores of this land scores of times to make me appreciate rather deeply what we have here. And as I return, I often think of the words of Scott when he said, "Breathes there a man with soul so dead who never to himself has said, 'This is my own, my native land,' whose heart hath ne'er within him burned as home his footsteps he has turned from wandering on a foreign strand. If such there breeze, go mark him well," and so on. And sometimes I think of the words of Van Dyke in that great poem, "America for Me," part of which goes, "It's nice to see the old world and travel up and down among the famous palaces and cities of renown, to view the crumbly castles and statues of the kings, but now I think I've had enough of antiquated things. So it's home again, and home again, America for me. I want a ship that's westward bound to plow the rolling sea, to the land of youth and freedom beyond the ocean bars, where the air is full of sunlight and the flag is full of stars. And so tonight, I appreciate more than I can say this opportunity to speak to you frankly as an American, one who prizes his citizenship in this blessed land. It seems appropriate that I should say a few words in regards to freedom and liberty. It is by vigilance of business people such as you represent who rely on our great, inspired free enterprise system that our liberties will be maintained. However, far too many today are enjoying a comfortable complacency. As a lead into my message, I quote from my friend Dean Clarence Mannion in the Mannion Forum Bulletin of July 3, 1977. He said, "In these days of pompous, highbrow drivel about the establishment of human rights throughout the world, it is most encouraging to find two distinguished university professors publishing jointly the following fact of history." Listen to it. "Humanity has survived in various states of tyranny for thousands of years. One might even say this is the natural state of affairs for man. Future historians may look back and see the period 1776 to 1976 as a brief 200-year accident, and I don't believe it's an accident, in the history of man in which real freedom existed for all. Yes, we are a prosperous nation. Our people have high-paying jobs. Our incomes are high. Our standard of living is at an unprecedented level. We do not like to be disturbed as we enjoy our life of ease.
We live in the soft present and feel the future is secure. We do not worry about history. We seem oblivious to the causes of the rises and fall of nations. We are blind to the hard fact that nations usually sow the seeds of their own destruction while enjoying unprecedented prosperity. I say to you with all the fervor of my soul, we are sowing the seeds of our own destruction in America and much of the free world today. It is my sober warning to you today that if the trends of the past 40 years, and especially the past 15 years, continue, we will lose that which is as priceless as life itself, our freedom, our liberty, our right to act as free men. It can happen here. It is happening here. The outlook for free enterprise in the world has never seemed so uncertain as now. Nationalization is growing rapidly, especially outside the Western Hemisphere. Many nations have a mixed economy, brought about by an increase in state control and a corresponding weakening of the private enterprise system. In our own country, we unmistakably see a trend toward welfare statism, what one has called a pension fund socialism. It seems in vogue for some to raise the question, will capitalism survive? More appropriately, the question might be stated, do we as American citizens have the desire and will for capitalism, free enterprise, to survive? Today it seems evident that we are rearing a generation of Americans who do not understand the productive base of our society and how we came by such prosperity. Evidence of this fact is found in surveys taken among some of our high school and college students, the majority of whom, it is reported, believe private enterprise is a failure, although they don't have a clear understanding of what private enterprise is. With them, as with many adults, there is a vague notion that it is some unfair system which tends to give special advantage to big corporations and wealthy individuals. From a study done by the Joint Council of Economic Education in 1973, 50% of the high school students could not distinguish between collectivism and a free enterprise society. 50% did not know the United States economy was based on free enterprise. From another study done by the Opinion Research Corporation, the median estimate of the U.S. public was that corporation profits are 28% of the sales dollar. Actually, profits are 4 or 5%. These attitudes may be the result of the propaganda by certain textbook writers who hold the idea in many instances that a planned economy is the remedy for all of our economic ills and the weaknesses in our American way of life, to which they readily point without referring to the beneficent fruits of the system. Before a welfare state can flourish, a welfare state mentality must have taken root. Are we not today yielding the harvest of seeds sown from the days of the Great Depression to the present? The ethic of today seems calculated to indoctrinate our citizens toward a dependency on the state. Our founding fathers recognized that certain rights are inalienable. That is God-given. Today the state is being looked to as the guarantor of human rights, life, liberty, and property. Our forebears practiced the biblical ethic that man should earn his bread by the sweat of his own brow. Today's ethic seems to be that it is right to be supported by the sweat of another's brow. Tonight, may I state the case for the free market and how it operates. You folks know already pretty well how it operates. I would also emphasize why a free market is essential to retaining political and economic freedoms. The more I become acquainted with the appalling lack of understanding of our free market system, the more I become convinced that we must return to something of a basic primer to explain our economic system. Perhaps this parable will illustrate. Two fathers lived side by side as neighbors. Each had two sons. Both fathers had good jobs, roomy homes, and material means to provide the best of life's luxuries. The essential difference between the two fathers was one of philosophy. Mr. A's objective with his two sons was to instill principles that would bring about self-respect, personal responsibility, and independence. His methods merit our scrutiny. When his boys were young, he taught them how to work at simple tasks by his side. When they became more mature, he developed a work incentive program. The pay scale was commensurate to the quality of the work performed. An average job, for example, paid 50 cents, above average 60, an exceptional job 75. A $1 job was the impossible task, a goal which he soon observed the boys were striving after. He impressed on his sons that the only limitation of their earnings were their personal initiative and desire. He emphasized the necessity to postpone immediate wants so they could save for the future. The lessons were well learned over a period of time. There was an undergirding moral element to Mr. A's philosophy, a principle more caught than taught. A simple example will suffice. One day the boys, now young men, were working in Mr. A's plant. He observed some sloppy work being done on one of the products. He asked to see the product and proceeded to remove the nameplate. One of the boys resisted. "Why are you doing that, Dad?" Mr. A replied, "I'll not have my name attached to a shoddy product. When my name goes on, my customers must know I've given them my best workmanship. Would you want to own this product?" It was an answer which provided a lesson which would last a lifetime. How could the golden rule be emphasized more effectively in business? Mr. B also had a philosophy, albeit a reactionary one to his early struggles of youth. "I'll not have my kids go through what I did." His philosophy was designed to remove the struggle from life. His method also merits our consideration. Regularly, his sons were provided with generous allowances. Little work in their formative years was expected. In later years, the boys were encouraged to work, but were now too comfortable in their security. After all, they had all their material wants satisfied. At this juncture, Mr. B made a profound discovery. Wants always exceed basic needs and are never satisfied unless disciplined. To counteract the lack of self-discipline, Mr. B embarked on a routine of imposed restraints. To his chagrin, he found his boys embittered toward him, ungrateful, and frequently disobedient to the rules imposed on them. Need I draw the conclusions from this parable? Is it not apparent which philosophy leads to a productive, contributive member of society and which philosophy sponsors dependency? Is it not also apparent which philosophy will best prepare one for emotional or economic crises? I do not apologize for the simplicity of the illustration. One may argue that the characters are exaggerated, but even a child can understand the effects of Mr. B's caretaker philosophy. Is not this philosophy analogous in many ways to the government official who argues, quote, "In this country, welfare is no longer charity. It is a right. More and more Americans feel that their government owes them something," unquote. But it is not Mr. B's philosophy which commands our attention tonight. It is Mr. A's. Why is it that the elements in his philosophy are so unfamiliar to so many that they believe that their government owes them something? Our task is to make Mr. A's philosophy both familiar and credible. When it is understood and believed, it will be defended with the same vigor and determination that made our founding fathers pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Many view the idea of the free enterprise or the free market system as only an alternative economic system to other systems. This is a serious oversight and causes many to miss the most crucial element to the free market system. May I mention some of these features? First, the free market system rests on a moral base. Before one can appreciate why this premise is true, two questions must be answered. First, what is man? The second question, a corollary to the first, is from what source does man derive his rights? Our governmental system, like ancient Israel and biblical Christianity, recognized man as a special creature of God, a special creation of God. He is not, as some theorists reason, a product of chance, or merely an educated animal. His paternal origin comes from God. Thus, man inherently possesses God-implanted attributes and potential. Reason, free agency, judgment, compassion, initiative, and a personal striving for perfection. From what source does man derive his rights? There can be only two possible sources of man's rights. Rights are either God-given as part of the divine plan, or they are grounded by government as part of the political plan. Reason, necessity, tradition, and religious convictions all led the founding fathers of this republic to accept the divine origin of these rights. If we accept the premise that human rights are granted by government, then we must be willing to accept the corollary that they can be denied by government. I, for one, shall never accept that premise. As the French political economist Frédéric Bastiat phrased it so succinctly, life, liberty, and property do not exist because men have made laws. On the contrary, it was the fact that life, liberty, and property existed beforehand that caused men to make laws in the first place. Unquote. Since God created man with certain inalienable rights, and man in turn created government to help secure and safeguard those rights, it follows that man is superior to government and should remain master over it, not the other way around. Even the non-believer can appreciate the logic of this relationship. Thus we see that the principle of supremacy of the individual over government is rooted in religious precept. This is why the founders of our nation were so influenced by the writings of John Locke, which declared that man was naturally in a state of perfect freedom, that he had a right to preservation and property, and that the source of all this was God. The founding fathers recognized that no people can maintain freedom unless their political institutions are founded on faith in God and belief in the existence of moral law. They realized that to survive, this new nation needed a reliance on the protection of God. In the Declaration of Independence, we find their appeal to the supreme judge of the world and to the laws of nature and nature's God. The document concludes with their affirmation of a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. The implication of this moral basis to our political economic system is that God is the dispenser of man's rights, not government. The inalienable right of free choice is implanted in the human breast. Man is born to choose for himself. This is why man cannot be driven indefinitely or led by despotic leaders to intellectual, physical, or economic bondage. Fear and despotism may rule for a generation, two or three, but in time the human spirit rebels. The spirit of liberty manifests itself, and the tyrannical hand of despotism is overthrown. May it ever be so. Once a person awakens to the truth of his divine identity, he demands his rights, the right to property, the right to make his own decisions, the right to plan his own welfare, the right to improve himself materially, intellectually, and spiritually. Second, the free market is based on the right to property. The right to property is again based on a scriptural precept. It recognizes that the earth belongs to the Lord,
that he created it for man's blessing and benefit. Thus, man's desire to own property, his own home and goods, his own business, is desirable and good. Utopian and communitarian schemes which eliminate property rights are not only unworkable, they deny to man his inherent desire to improve his station. They are therefore contrary to the pursuit of happiness. No property rights. Man's incentive would be diminished to satisfying only his barest necessities, such as food and clothing. How this truth is evident in the communist countries today. No property rights, no incentive to enter individual enterprise, to risk one's own capital because the fruits of one's labor could not be enjoyed. No property rights, no contractual relationship to buy and sell, since title to possession of goods could not be granted. No property rights, no recognition of divine law which prohibits man from stealing and coveting others' possessions. One cannot steal that which belongs to everyone, nor can he covet that which is not another's. No property rights, no possibility of the sanctity of one's own home and the joy which comes from creation, production, and ownership. A free market philosophy recognizes property rights as sacred. Because the individual is entitled to ownership of goods and property which he has earned, he is sovereign, so far as human law is concerned, over his own goods. He may retain possession of his goods. He may pass his wealth on to his family or to charitable causes. For one cannot give what one does not own. James Madison recognized that property consisted not only of man's external goods, his land, merchandise, or money, but most sacredly, he had title to his thoughts, opinions, and conscience. The civil government's obligation, then, is to safeguard this right and to frame laws which secure to every man the free exercise of his conscience and the right and control of his property. No liberty is possible except a man is protected in his title to his legal holdings and property and can be indemnified by the law for its loss or destruction. Remove this right and man is reduced to serfdom. Former United States Supreme Court Justice George Sutherland said it this way: to give man liberty but take from him the property which is the fruit and badge of his liberty is to still leave him a slave, unquote. Third, the free market is based on the right to enjoy private enterprise for profit. As a country, we have suffered under half a century of liberal propaganda demeaning economic success. This was done by referring to men who are willing to risk their capital, their profit, in tools and equipment as coupon clippers, economic royalists, capitalists, and profiteers, as though there were something inherently evil in profit. Profit is the reward for honest labor. It is the incentive that causes a man to risk his capital to build a business. If he cannot keep or invest that which he has earned, neither may he own, nor will he risk. Profit creates wealth. Wealth creates more work opportunities, and more work opportunities creates greater wealth. None of this is possible without incentive. There is another benefit to profit. It provides man with moral choices. With profit, man can choose to be greedy and selfish. He can invest and expand, thereby providing others with jobs. And he can be charitable. Charity is not charity unless it is voluntary. It cannot be voluntary if there is nothing to give. Only saved profit creates more jobs, not government. The only way government can create jobs is to take the money from productive citizens in the form of taxes
and transfer it to government programs without someone generating profit, which can be taxed, government revenue is not possible. Fourth, the free market is the right to voluntary exchange of goods and services, free from restraints and controls. Nothing is more to be prized, nor more sacred than man's free choice. Free choice is the essence of free enterprise. It recognizes that the common man will make choices in his own self-interest. It allows a manufacturer to produce what he wants, how much, and to set his own price. It allows the buyer to decide if he wants a certain product at the price established. It preserves the right to work when and where we choose. In his first inaugural address, Thomas Jefferson said that the sum of good government shall leave citizens free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. Unquote. Why does our system produce more bread, manufacture more shoes, and assemble more TV sets than Russian socialism? It does so precisely because our government does not guarantee these things. If it did, there would be so many accompanying taxes, controls, regulations, and political manipulations that the productive genius based on freedom of choice that is America's would soon be reduced to the floundering level of waste and inefficiency now found behind the Iron Curtain. When government presumes to demand more and more of the fruits of a man's labor through taxation, and reduces more and more his actual income by printing money and furthering debt, the wage earner is left with less and less to buy food, to provide housing, medical care, education, and private welfare. Individuals are then left without a choice and must look to the state as its benevolent supporter of these services. When that happens, liberty is gone. Fifth, a free market survives with competition. Were it not for competition among goods or services, there would be no standard by which a buyer could discern shoddy merchandise or inept service from excellence. Were it not for competition, the seller could price his goods and services according to his own fancy. It is competition that determines what is good, better, and best. It is competition that determines the price for products or services. If goods are overpriced in comparison with other comparable goods, the buyer refuses to buy, thus forcing a seller to drop his price. There is a glaring paradox in our society. On the one hand, legislation has been enacted to allegedly prevent one business or combination of businesses, monopolies, from disrupting or eliminating competitors in the market. On the other hand, we have yet to fully awaken to the worst form of monopolistic practice currently impeding the free market. I refer to government monopoly, when government, by either ownership or regulation, prevents the full freedom of action by sellers. This, of course, regulates and controls prices. No better example exists today than the so-called energy crisis. As a nation, we have artificially regulated the price of natural gas for over 20 years. The Federal Power Commission has set prices and burdened the oil industry with regulations. Consequently, the oil industry has not had the incentive to discover natural gas or drill for oil, even though the reserves are there. The environmentalists, with the help of activist lawyers, have combined to make it almost impossible to drill for oil economically. What industry wants to risk its capital, fighting through the hearings and lawsuits, which double and treble its investment costs. So exploration does not take place. Our reserves are kept off the market to await the day when the government will deregulate. Reserves. The most effective energy policy our government could devise would be to step out of the regulatory business.
This would provide, once again, the incentives for industry to make investment and exploration. Freedom from bureaucratic monopoly is essential to allowing our free market to work effectively. I hope we wake up to this serious lesson before our freedoms are lost altogether. We have talked so far about the vital elements to a free market operation. How does it all work together to bring about needed goods and services? Let me illustrate. There could be many illustrations. How do our cities and towns each day obtain the quantity of food products they demand? Of all agencies engaged in supplying cities with food, almost none knows how much the city consumes or how much is being produced. Despite this ignorance, the cities receive about the amount of food needed without great surplus or shortage. How is this accomplished without a central directing body telling each producer what it should produce? The answer, of course, is the operation of the free market, free enterprise in action. Suppose, for example, that a given city did not receive the amount of food products needed to satisfy its demand. Rather than go without, many people would be willing to pay higher prices. Thus, prices would increase, and the volume of production would rise, or the volume flowing to that city would increase. This would end the shortage. More food would be shipped to that city, and less to other places. Or suppose that there was an oversupply of food products. To avert spoilage, the seller would lower his price. This, in turn, is a signal to the producer to cut back on production. Thus, the oversupply is automatically regulated. Less food is shipped to that city and more to other cities. No bureau in all of Washington could perform this service. It has been tried and failed in many industries. Just as price regulates the distribution of food in a given city, so it also determines the total amount produced in the country. Greater profits provide farmers with the incentive to produce a greater product. If the supply increases at a pace faster than the demand for the product, farmers and ranchers are compelled to lower their prices. As it becomes less profitable to produce, potential producers, marginal producers, are deterred from engaging in this occupation, and the unprofitable producers divert to something else or abandon farming altogether. This is how this remarkable system works. This is how it has built this nation as the strongest nation in the world. Yes, this is how it works in all industries. When government and planning controls and price fixing are left out, yet few of our citizens seem to understand this. Economic literacy among our people has not been one of the bright spots in our 200-year-old history. Yet it is apparent that when ignorance prevails, the people eventually suffer. The principles behind our American free market economy can be reduced to a rather simple formula. Here it is. And I hope if you forget everything else I've said, you'll remember this formula. It is so basic and so simple. 1, economic security for all is impossible without widespread abundance. Abundance is impossible without industrious and efficient production. 3, such production is impossible without energetic, willing, and eager labor. 4, this labor is not possible without incentive. 5, of all forms of incentive, the freedom to attain a reward for one's labors is the most sustaining for most people. Sometimes called the profit motive, it is simply the right to plan and to earn and to enjoy the fruits of your labor. 6, this profit motive diminishes as government controls, regulations, and taxes increase to deny the fruits of success to those who produce. 7, therefore any attempt through government intervention to redistribute the material rewards of labor can only result in the eventual destruction of the productive base of society, without which real abundance and security for more than the ruling elite is quite impossible. Yes, what worked for Mr. A in producing self-disciplined, responsible, contributive sons to society works for a community. What works for a community will work for a state. And what works for the state will work for this nation. If we as American citizens demand that government officials perform only those duties provided by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The Constitution of the United States, an inspired document, is a solemn agreement between the citizens of this nation that every officer of government is under a sacred duty to obey. The Constitution provides that the great bulk of the legitimate activities of government are to be carried out at the state or local level. This is the only way in which the principle of self-government can be made effective and safeguarded. The smallest or lowest level that can possibly undertake the task is the one that should do so. The smaller the government unit, and the closer it is to the people, the easier it is to guide it, to correct it, to keep it solvent, and to keep our freedom. A category of government activity that poses the gravest danger to our continued freedom is the activity not within the proper sphere of government. The Constitution provides the federal government with no authority to grant such powers as welfare programs, schemes for redistributing the wealth, and activities that coerce people into acting in accordance with a prescribed code of social planning. There is one simple test to the constitutionality of a principle. Do I, as an individual, have a right to use force upon my neighbor to accomplish this goal? If I do, then I may delegate that power to my government to exercise it in my behalf. If I do not have that right, I cannot delegate it. If we permit government to manufacture its own authority and to create self-proclaimed powers not delegated to it by the people, then the creature exceeds the creator and becomes master. Who is to say this far but no farther? What clear principle will stay the hand of government from reaching farther and farther into our daily lives? Grover Cleveland said that though the people support the government should not support the people. Once government steps over this clear line between the protective or negative role into the aggressive role of redistributing the wealth through taxation and providing so-called benefits for some of its citizens, it becomes a means for legalized plunder. Examples abound in the world of the failure of alternative systems to the free market. What amazes me is that we cannot see from their example the obvious failure of socialism, what it does to a nation's economy, and how it morally debilitates a people. Great Britain is a tragic example of this. I was there just a short time ago. Here is a nation that I love, and here is a nation which has provided the free world with a tradition of freedom and democratic rights stemming from Magna Carta and coming down through other important historical documents and statements by famous Englishmen. Yet England today is losing her freedom. She has become a giant welfare state. Today, government spending in Britain amounts to 60% of her total national income. This is socialism. Medical doctors under socialized medicine are leaving Great Britain in record numbers, as are thousands of others. British Prime Minister James Callaghan, in a speech last September, said, quote, "We used to think that you could just spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candor that that option no longer exists, and that insofar as it ever did exist, it only worked by injecting bigger doses of inflation into the economy. followed by higher levels of unemployment as the next step. That is the history of the past 20 years, unquote. Such a confession has led the renowned economist Dr. Milton Friedman to comment, quote, "That must surely rank as one of the most remarkable and courageous statements ever made by a leader of a democratic government. Read it again. Savor it. It is a confession of the intellectual bankruptcy of the policy that has guided every British government in the post-war period, not only Labour governments, but also Tory governments, of the policy that has guided almost every other Western government, including the United States, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, of the policy that is now being recommended to Mr. Carter by his advisors," unquote. Consider another example. Our neighbor to the north, Canada. For 20 years, 1944 to 1964, Saskatchewan, Canada, lived under a socialist government. Here is what their premier, the Honorable W. Ross Thatcher, said about this experience. Quote, "In 1944, the socialists said they would solve the unemployment problems by building government factories. They promised to use the profits to build highways, schools, hospitals, and to finance better social welfare measures generally. Over the years, they set up 22 so-called crown or government corporations. By the time we had taken over, at the end of the 20-year period, 12 of the crown corporations had gone bankrupt or been disposed of. Others were kept operating by repeated and substantial government grants. During the whole period, the socialists waged war against private business. The making of profits was condemned as an unforgivable sin. What was the result? Investors simply turned their backs on the socialists. Dozens of oil companies pulled up stakes and moved out. Gas exploration ground to a complete halt. Prospecting in our vast north became almost non-existent. During the period, Canada was experiencing the greatest economic boom in her history. Saskatchewan received only a handful of new factories. After 18 years of socialism, there were fewer jobs in manufacturing than existed in 1945. This despite the investment of $500 million in crown corporations. During the period, more than 600 completely new taxes were introduced. 650 other taxes were increased. Per capita taxes in Saskatchewan were soon substantially out of line with our sister provinces. One more reason why industry located elsewhere. The socialists promised to make Saskatchewan a mecca for the working man. Instead, we saw the greatest mass exodus of people out of an area since Moses led the Jews out of Egypt. Since the war, 270,000 of our citizens left Saskatchewan to find employment elsewhere. If there are any Americans who think that socialism is the answer, I wish they would come to Saskatchewan to study what has happened to our province." Unquote. We say it can't happen here. The lesson of New York City should tell us that this same thing is happening here to us now. As Dr. Friedman has pointed out, New York City is no longer governed by its elected officials. It is governed by a committee of overseers appointed by the state of New York. New York City has partially lost its freedom. When will we learn the lesson? That fiscal irresponsibility leads to a loss of self-government. When will we learn that when you lose economic independence, you lose political freedom? We have accepted a frightening degree of socialism in our country. The question is how much? The amount of freedom depends upon the amount of federal control and spending. A good measurement is to determine the amount or percentage of income of the people which is taken over and spent by the state. In Russia, the individual works almost wholly for the state, leaving little for his own welfare. Scandinavia takes about 65 to 70% of the increase of the people. England, some 60%. The United States is now approximately 44%. America was built on the principle of faith in God, self-reliance, the profit motive, individual action, and voluntary charity. It was built by those who believed that the surest helping hand was at the end of their own sleeves. These forefathers of ours shared one thing in common, an unshakable faith in God and a faith in themselves. There are indications that America is moving away from the philosophy that made her the most prosperous nation in the world. In effect, we are moving toward the philanthropic philosophy of Mr. B and abandoning the work incentive philosophy of Mr. A. Mr. B's philosophy has crept in unawares under the guise of a new name, egalitarianism. It is, of course, the socialist doctrine of equality. It struck a sympathetic chord with most Americans because its initial goal was equality of rights. Today, however, the goal for the proponents of equality is to restructure our entire economic system using the power of the federal government to enforce their grand design. They now advocate throughout our economy that we redistribute wealth and income, a good definition of socialism. Our present middle-of-the-road policy is, as Van Mises, whom I class as the greatest economy that we have ever known, suggested socialism by the installment plan. Americans have always been committed to taking care of the poor, aged, and unemployed. We've done this on the basis of Judaic Christian beliefs and humanitarian principles. It has been fundamental to our way of life that charity must be voluntary if it is to be charity. Compulsory benevolence is not charity. Today's egalitarians are using the federal government to redistribute wealth in our society, not as a matter of voluntary charity, but as a matter of right. The chief weapon used by the federal government to achieve this equality is through so-called transfer payments. This is a term which simply means that the federal government collects from one income group and transfers payments to another by the tax system. These payments are made in the form of Social Security benefits, housing subsidies, Medicare, food stamps, to name a few. Today, total costs of such programs will exceed $150 billion annually. That represents about 44% of the total of all government federal spending, or about $1 out of every $7 of personal income. When will we resolve as Americans that a dollar cannot make the trip to Washington, D.C. and back without a bureaucratic bite being taken out of it? Medicaid, the government's regular health program for the poor, cost taxpayers $13 billion in 75. Medicare, the program for the disabled and elderly, cost $15 billion. Aid to families with dependent children cost over $5 billion. And about $3 billion is spent on food stamps. This is today only a few of the so-called benefits paid out. Our present Social Security program has been going in the hole at the rate of $12 billion a year. And yet the party now in power wants to increase the benefits to include a comprehensive national health insurance program. Recognizing that the present program will be insolvent by 1985, President Carter has now recommended that Social Security be funded out of the General Income Tax Fund. Charges were made in the last election campaign that the Social Security program was going bankrupt. These charges were denied. Now the truth is out. The president's recommendation must be regarded as an admission of the failure of the present system and as a calculated policy to take this country into full-scale socialism. Our major danger is that we are currently and have been for 40 years transferring responsibility from the individual local and state governments to the federal government, precisely the same course which led to the economic collapse of Great Britain and New York. We cannot long pursue this present trend without it bringing us to national insolvency. Edmund Burke, the great British political philosopher, warned of the threat of egalitarianism, socialism. He said a perfect equality will indeed be produced. That is to say, equal wretchedness, equal beggary, and on the part of the petitioners, a woeful, helpless, and desperate disappointment. Such is the event of all compulsory equalizations. They pull down what is above, they never raise what is below, and they depress high and low together beneath the level of what was originally the lowest." Unquote. All would like to equalize with those who are better off than themselves, I suppose. They fail to realize that incomes differ and will always differ because people differ in their economic drive and ability. History indicates that governments have been unable to prevent inequality of incomes. Further equalization efforts stifle initiative and retard progress to the extent that the real incomes of everyone are lowered. We must remember that government assistance and control are essentially political provisions, and that experience has demonstrated that for that reason they are not sufficiently stable to warrant their utilization as a foundation for sound economic growth under a free enterprise system. The best way, the American way, is still maximum freedom for the individual, guaranteed by a wise government that provides for the police protection and national defense. History records that eventually people get the form of government they deserve. Good government, which guarantees the maximum of freedom, liberty, and development to the individual, must be based upon sound principles. We must ever remember that ideas and principles are either sound or unsound in spite of those who hold them. Freedom of achievement has produced and will continue to produce the maximum of benefits in terms of human welfare. Freedom is an eternal principle. Heaven disapproves of force, coercion, and intimidation. Only a free people can be truly a happy people. Of all sad things in the world, the saddest is to see a people who have once known liberty and freedom and then lost it. I have seen the unquenchable yearning of the human heart for liberty. On an unforgettable occasion, yes, on several occasions, this particular experience is indelibly etched on the memory of my soul. I saw this yearning spirit in the faces of many European people in the aftermath of World War II. It fell my lot under the direction of the president of the church to be among the first to go without my family into war-torn European countries and distribute food, clothing, and bedding to the suffering members of our church and others. I saw during that year-long visit firsthand entire nations prostrate, flat on their backs economically. I looked into the face of hunger, the pale, the thin, the many dressed in rags and some barefooted. I saw the refugees, the poor, unwanted souls, who
who were driven from their homes to destinations unknown. They came with all their earthly possessions on their backs. I visited some of their homes, shacks, where as many as 22 people were living in one room, four complete families. I saw men enslaved by habit, barter their scanty ration of food and clothing for a cigarette. I saw some fortunate to get hold of an American magazine and pore over its pages and wonder if what they saw could possibly be true. I saw once happy, freedom-loving people in bondage under godless leadership. I saw the struggle on every hand to get to America, some legal and others illegal, all in an effort to enjoy freedom and liberty. These were the people, many of them, who had once known some freedom, but had lost it. Yes, we are a prosperous people today because of a political, economic system founded on spiritual values, not material values alone. It is founded on freedom of choice, free agency, an eternal God-given principle, and personal virtue. The Founding Fathers, inspired though they were, did not invent the priceless blessings of individual freedom and respect for the dignity of man. No, that priceless gift to mankind sprang from the God of heaven and not from government. Recognizing this truth, they forged the safeguards that would bind men's lust for power to the Constitution. They recognized that freedom must be perpetually preserved to be enjoyed. Each new generation must learn that truth anew. Yes, America's foundation is spiritual. Without the moral base to our system, we are no better off than any other nations which are now sunk into oblivion. There are some in this land, among whom I count myself, whose faith it is that this land is reserved for only a righteous people. And we remain here as tenants only as we remain in the favor of the Lord. And He is the landlord as far as this earth is concerned. If we are to remain under heaven's benign protection and care, we must return to those principles which have brought us our peace, liberty, and prosperity. Our problems today are essentially problems of the spirit. We here in America, as Theodore Roosevelt said over a half century ago, hold in our hands the hope of the world, the fate of the coming years, and shame and disgrace will be ours if in our eyes the light of high resolve is dimmed, if we trail in the dust the golden hopes of men. Unquote. You gathered here tonight are dedicated to maintain that light of high resolve in the American people. As you do so, may I leave with you this challenge, that you help others see that the real issue is not a debate over economic systems. It is the issue of freedom, and limited or no freedom, the same issue that brought about this nation's birth and independence. Yes, with God's help and inspiration, perhaps we may rekindle a flame of liberty that will last as long as time endures. For this I pray, and thank you for this opportunity of meeting with you tonight.